transitions, of course, have multiple, tell us multiple things about what lies in store. Not all forms of government have transitions. Parliamentary systems don't. We do. And it basically, I think there are three different ways in which the transition is an important sign into what an administration will look like. First of all, it sets the tone for an administration. Is it chaotic? Is it organized? Is it centralized? Is it pragmatic? Is it ideological? On the last point, ideological, I think it's important to note that divisions within the Democratic Party, as is also the case within the Republican Party, divisions, ideological divisions, were largely submerged throughout the election in the pursuit of victory. Now, that's smart, of course. It may not always be possible to maintain that over time. In both parties, Democratic Party and the Republican Party, there is what I will call a dark fringe when it comes to Middle East issues, when it comes to international issues in general. This dark fringe sees America as a global villain, sees Israel as albatross, sees Middle Easterners as universal victims. This was not the foreign policy of Barack Obama, as enunciated in the campaign. This was not the foreign policy enunciated by the Democratic Party as it swept to victory. It will be very interesting and I think very important to see whether the fringe of the party that does advance these views begins now to spread its wings and make a claim for a seat at the foreign policy table in the wake of victory, and to see whether and how the president-elect approaches that ideological divide, which exists, has existed, and exists in that party as well as the Republican Party. Secondly, transitions provide, through the choice of personnel and the first wave of appointments, a clear sense of an administration's direction. I was flying back from Paris over the weekend and watched, totally unrelated to anything connected to the Middle East, watched an interview with prominent movie directors, and Rob Reiner said something which stuck with me, which is, casting is the most important part of making a movie. Once you have the cast, directing the movie is simple. And I think that applies no less to administrations as it does to making a movie. There are essentially three different models that we should look out for. If you look back on how administrations have approached their foreign policy casting for the last, really the last generation. There is the model of the strong secretary. Jim Baker comes to mind. There's the model of the special envoy-driven approach. And I think we had that to a great extent in the second Clinton administration. And then there's the model of the White House-run foreign policy, which is the most archetypical example of this is the first Nixon administration. Weak secretary, strong national security advisor, White House-run foreign policy. My bet is the third model is the least likely in an Obama administration. But I think there is somewhat of a debate underway as to which of the first two models, strong secretary or special envoy model, is the model that that will be adopted. And I think if you look at the potential candidates that are, you know, in the press rumored, you will see examples of each of these represented. Not each of the examples for Secretary of State lends themselves to being the strong secretary, or not each lends themselves to the special envoy model. But it is a strategic decision, really, about how you approach foreign policy. And I think we will learn a lot in the next couple of weeks on that. Thirdly, transitions provide an interlude in which the new leader gets to restate the problem that he faces. He gets to lower expectations. Perhaps most importantly, it's an opportunity for events to occur that totally reset the agenda for the post-inauguration. This is when new leaders get a chance to say, wow, who knew? Who knew how complicated it really is? Who knew how difficult the problem really is? Who knew what bad shape we're really in? That's exactly what happens in every transition when they get to see the books, when they get to get the briefings, when they get to hear what the incumbent has been keeping. Because, of course, the incumbent is usually involved in the campaign in one way or the other. This is the time for foreign leaders, friend and foe, to put down markers. We've already seen this happen. We've seen it happen with Europe in terms of friend putting down a marker, and with Russia putting down a marker about missiles. Events happen in transitions. Sometimes these are created abroad. I remember very well in the Clinton transition, everyone speaks about, of course, the Somalia events. In the Arab-Israeli context, there was the example of the Hamas deportees, which Warren Christopher immediately launched into Middle East diplomacy in day one to deal with this urgent crisis. Sometimes events are created by the lame duck administration itself. And again, in the Middle East context, the one that is most often cited was the handover from Reagan to George Bush the Elder in terms of launching the dialogue with the PLO, an event which changed American Middle East policy at a moment of transition in November of 1988. Are there things that the current Bush administration could conceivably do in the interim that would change the landscape for President-elect Obama? Well, sure. There are at least three that come to mind. One, a statement of peace process policy, which I think is being rumored, and perhaps David will say a bit more about this in his comments. Second, less likely, but one can never rule it out, unilateral military action on Iran. I think the chances, as I said, have gone down considerably for this, but that would certainly change the landscape. Third, something which actually happened just 2 weeks ago, and we can't rule out the possibility that it will happen with even greater ferocity and greater implications at some point in the next 3 months, military action elsewhere. We saw it in Syria, where the United States and a major Middle East player in the closing days of an election had a military confrontation. The ramifications probably are going to not be too lasting, I think, from that military confrontation, but one cannot preclude the possibility of another such event occurring in the next 3 months with implications that would be more far-reaching. Now, as we move from transition to post-inauguration, on the substance, this election was about change. Now, about a year ago, for most Americans, change referred to changing course on the Iraq War. Today, for most Americans, change refers to change on the economy. It is now a universal truism that economics will be the new president's top priority. That will likely include an effort to do what is necessary on foreign policy without stirring up unwanted problems, without charting unlikely goals, and without making huge commitments. About 6 weeks ago at our Institute's annual Weinberg Founders Conference, when I asked then-Senator Obama's advisor, Richard Danzig, former Navy Secretary, to encapsulate what an Obama foreign policy might look like in one of those catchphrases that we traditionally apply to foreign policy or to policy in general, he offered as his catchphrase, quote, sustainable security, which is as good a phrase as any, but which is certainly not a phrase which implies bold new initiatives, grand plans, or world-changing ideas. Sustainable security. Now, while globalization blurs the distinction between foreign and domestic, traditional foreign policy issues will, if the new team has its way, likely take a back seat. And as the new administration tries to rank its own priorities on foreign policy, top spots seem to be going to Pakistan and Afghanistan, Russia, the international financial system, and of course, how to manage the promised drawdown in Iraq. Other Middle East issues may not make it into the top of the list. Iran will try to break into that top five. There's a chance it'll be right there, hovering at trying to break into it. the Middle East peace process will have a very rough time breaking into that top tier. But that's a very two-dimensional way of looking at this. The Middle East, like other regions of the world, only more so, will stake its claim on the new president's limited time. Some in the Middle East will do this in a very positive way, by saving concessions, by saving promises, by saving opportunities so that Obama can take advantage of them. Others in the Middle East will do this in a testing and destructive way. I hope, though I have my doubts, that Syria is in the first category. I'm sadly confident that Iran, Hezbollah, and Sunni jihadists are in the second category. Now, as I said, my colleagues will talk about two of the most important sets of issues, relations with Israel and the Arab-Israeli peace process, relations in the Gulf. In the latter, I think it's important to note, America has been fighting land and naval wars for two decades. In the former, we've been engaged at a presidential level now in peacemaking for five straight administrations. It's doubtful in the end that President Obama is going to be able to escape personal engagement with either, even if he wanted to. I do want to make a few more specific comments. First, not about the Middle East peace process per se, but about how it might play into a general approach in the region. My reading is that for an Obama administration, the Middle East peace process is not only the answer to the question, how does one resolve the historic conflict between Arab and Jew over Palestine? It is also the answer, or at least a major part of the answer, to a larger question, which is, quote, how can America restore a relationship of respect and friendship with Arab and Muslim peoples and their governments? That's a very different question, and it's an answer which is not necessarily the answer one would give to that question, or it's certainly not the only answer one can give to that second question. I mention this because I think it's a lot to put on the back of the peace process at this moment of great leadership fragility, especially. It's a lot to put on the back of the peace process for it to be the answer to that second question, as well as the answer, of course, to the first. And if not handled very delicately, it has the potential to weigh down the protagonists with a burden far beyond one that they can bear. Second, I think at the same time, it would be tragic if an Obama administration threw the baby out with the bathwater in terms of the urgency of political reform in Arab and Muslim societies. Here, the Bush administration's errors, and most notably the backfiring of the Palestinian legislative election in 2006, which led to a Hamas victory, that made this entire issue radioactive in foreign policy terms. I think this would be a mistake if that radioactivity were allowed to transfer over to a new administration. Indeed, the only two groups in the Middle East that would be cheering this would be the autocrats and the radicals. I think done right, we can promote the conditions for positive change. And we should not lose confidence, it seems to me, in our ability to do it right. Third, in terms of peacemaking, again, more broadly, I do think there is an opportunity for President-elect Obama to make a contribution in an area which is beyond the typical, to do far more than just diplomacy with greater vigor and activity. That is, you know, more of the Oslo roadmap and just doing it better. I think he has an opportunity to be a change agent on the normative aspect of peacemaking. That's not just the important and necessary haggling over territory and security that we who are fixated on the peace process tend to be absorbed in, but also the psychological, the emotional, the intellectual, the ideological contest over legitimacy, which is really at the heart of the barrier to peacemaking. Here, I would personally like to see that his great and unique contribution is to help bring about a historic Arab acceptance of Israel as a Jewish state. And if he invests in that effort early and hard, and if that effort can bear some visible results, then I think it's fair to say that no Israeli government, Likud, Kadima, or Labor, will be able to withhold compromise on the issues most dear to the Arab side of the negotiation. In terms of Iran, I won't tread on Patrick other than to make these brief points. First, new administrations historically have difficulty finding the right balance between seeking consultation with allies and coming to office with ideas of their own and projecting leadership on those ideas. The world is schizophrenic. The world wants America to listen more. The world also wants America to lead. It's not easy to find the balance between the two. The Clinton administration fumbled early on this when Warren Christopher went to Europe in May of 1993. The agenda was Bosnia. Europe expected America to be leading with a plan of its own, and Secretary Christopher went to listen. The end was 2 years of lost time and effort and lives, that some analysts think was the case. Iran, potentially, is the Bosnia of 2009, the test of where the administration draws the line between listening and leading. If we are too independent, too creative, and we lose the will of Europeans who carried the torch on the fight against any Iranian enrichment for years. If we're too timid and deferential, we lose the Euro craving and the Arab need for American leadership, without which, I'm quite confident that we will see an Iranian nuclear weapons capability before too long. Secondly, his advisors, that is, President-elect Obama's advisors, have almost across the board endorsed the strategy of prevention rather than a strategy of deterrence. You could see this in the first Washington Institute Presidential Study Group report this year, in which Tony Lake and Susan Rice were proud signatories endorsing a strategy of prevention. We saw this at our Lansdowne conference when Richard Danzig rejected deterrence in favor of strategy of prevention. The simple point I'll make here is now we enter the tough moment. Prevention doesn't necessarily start with force, but at least in principle, it could end with force, and one has to contemplate that with seriousness and with resolve, and that is a sobering thought. Third, a key word on relationships. Relationships, this is what diplomacy is all about. Managing key relationships in the Middle East is not simple. There are 5 mega relationships with partner countries. I won't go into them in any detail. I'll just list them very briefly. There, Israel, Egypt, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, and let's of course not forget Iraq. This is not to suggest that other countries aren't important, but these are the mega relationships. They're all complicated. In none is there a single issue that predominates. But if there is one issue that does connect them all, it is Iran. Not because Iran is a regional superman, but because Iranians have acquired enough assets to cause mischief on multiple fronts. Therefore, getting our Iran policy straight is essential. In this regard, it's very interesting, to say the least, to follow the groundswell of support for retaining Secretary of Defense Gates at the Pentagon. Despite his many fine qualities, and qualities that have earned him the accolades of people across the aisle, on Iran, interestingly, he seems to be the opposite of what an Obama administration says that it is looking for. After all, I urge you to look at an overlooked speech he gave at NDU in late September, where he delivered a ringing defense of the Bush administration's approach on Iran. I'll quote, "It seems to me that the contacts that we've had at the ambassadorial level, the opportunity to engage in a dialogue should they be willing to stop their enrichment in some kind of verifiable way is not an unreasonable precondition to higher level talks. I think that until the Iranians decide that they take a different approach to the rest of the world, then we are probably not in a bad place at all on our Iran policy. Now that's, I would, just looking at the Obama team's approach to Iran throughout the election, that's a very far cry from how they have characterized the idea that we're not in a bad place versus the idea that we're in a very bad place in terms of how the administration is handling Iran. So that would be a very interesting selection to watch if one is focused principally on Iran. Two more large points. The 3 p.m. call. The 3 p.m. call.
3 a.m.
In my life, I'm up at 3 a.m. I have a one-year-old. The 3 a.m. call. It seems to me, as you look out in the next several months, there are a lot of possibilities for events that could make the president-elect's hair turn prematurely white. All sorts of, you can all have your own scenarios for terrorism, etc. I'll just mention four that I think deserve to be on everybody's potential list here. First, a collapse of the Palestinian Authority. I think this is a very real possibility, and I think David may talk about this in more detail, but this is one of those major events that I think actually has a not insignificant likelihood of happening. Secondly, Hezbollah takeover of Lebanon. I think we should recognize that sometime in the first 6 months, there is certainly an election in Lebanon, and the chances that the pro-Western forces get defeated by Hezbollah and its partners, I think, are sadly very real. Third, a succession issue in Egypt. I'm not going out on a limb by saying that at some point the octogenarian president of Egypt will pass the scene. We haven't had a major succession in Egypt now. We've never had since 1981. There is no vice president. There is a system that is opaque and unclear. This is a country where America has deep assets, deep investment, deep interests, in which the course of leadership there will have a profound impact on our ability to secure peace and stability in the region. And last, of course, is Iran. Iran nuclear success. I'll leave it at that. And this will change the course of an administration. My last comment is a humble word of advice to the president-elect. Keep a close look during the transition on the transition that your advisors themselves make. Before the election, their job is to keep you out of trouble. After the election, they are eager to win your interest in their issues. It's a very different responsibility. I remember watching this as I played a very bit part in the 92 transition. Bill Clinton, one should recall, ran on a platform that was to the right of George Bush on at least two issues, Syria and China. Bush, he said, was soft on both. Then, after his election, I recall participating in the drafting for the new president of his memo on the Middle East peace process. Gone was that tough language about Syria. In its place, I remember we offered President Clinton, President-elect Clinton, the enticing prospect of helping to engineer not one, not two, but three possible Arab-Israeli peace agreements, and the chance that he would be the change agent to bring about the end of conflict in the Holy Land. Well, that was the clincher. We were off to the races. Peace process became a major focus of the Clinton administration. My advice to the new president, keep your priorities. Look for opportunities. Husband the remarkable outpouring of goodwill you have from around the world to focus on the urgent matters first. Don't expend your energies drilling in a dry well. There's just too much to do in order to do that. Thank you very much.